Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Melissa Kirsch, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker.
And I'm Alice Bradley, Lifehacker's deputy editor.
And today we're talking about how to get out of debt.
Truly everyone's favorite topic.
It's such a fun topic. So, Alice, according to a report last year from the Urban Institute, there were an estimated 71 million adults in the U.S. who had debt in collections.
That is unbelievable.
That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. Hopefully we can help at least some of them today with advice from a very smart friend of the show, Farnoosh Torabi.
I think the first thing is actually to not really obsess over the numbers and really take a step back and think about what is the whole purpose of this? What will this afford you?
Farnoosh is an author, podcaster, and personal finance expert, and she joins us today on The Upgrade to help us figure out how to conquer our debt.
Longtime Upgrade listeners might also remember her from our episode back in April of this year when she taught us how to negotiate like a pro.
Yes, which is a skill which may actually come in handy when you're trying to get out of debt.
Very true.
But first, we're joined by Lifehacker staff writer Lisa Rowan, who answers both Upgrade listener questions and questions submitted by Lifehacker readers about credit cards.
For a lot of people, your routine spending is not going to be enough to earn you round-trip tickets to anywhere.
Alice?
Yes, Melissa?
Do you remember the first time you confronted debt in your life?
My confrontation of debt?
Yes.
I sure do.
When you came face-to-face with your own debt?
When I got a bill and I thought, oh no,
yes,
I don't have this money.
And what did you do?
I remember it well because I was just out of college, got my first credit card, went a little bit hog wild with it, and ended up amassing debt of something like $1,500, which at the time seemed insurmountable.
Mm-hmm.
I was making a really small income working as a, you know, editorial assistant, and boy, that was depressing. But I mostly panicked, didn't pay it for a while. It, of course, amassed, you know, penalties and late fees, and then I ended up slowly chipping away at it, getting rid of it, and then didn't use credit cards again for a few years. I was really nervous about them. I was like, these are poison. I'm never doing them again.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like there was a period of time where everybody I knew had a certain amount of debt on their credit cards, you know, that we were all living a little bit off of the credit cards and paying the minimums each month.
Yeah.
And then I got into the sort of credit card surfing. So I would surf different cards that had 0% APR for a certain amount of time, introductory offers so you could transfer all of your debt to one card, have it at 0% interest for a year, and then I would switch it to another card. Mm. There was always a little fee you had to pay, but I would calculate that the fee, you know, wasn't going to add too much more to the debt, you know, or more than I can handle. And that is actually how I ended up paying off my cards.
Amazing.
I can't recall how much I actually had on the cards at once, but it wasn't insignificant. It was probably $5,000.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's kind of getting into the area, at least for me, where it starts to feel like, oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how old were you when those things were coming?
I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
You know, it was in my 20s when I was constantly making little diagrams and charts and trying to figure out how I was going to not just make my rent, but feel okay about money. You know, like how much did I have to make in order to not be scared that I was going to run out of money?
Yeah. And when my debt accrued, I was so horrified and embarrassed that I didn't tell anybody and had no idea that other people were way more in debt than I was.
Yeah.
Not to mention like student loan debt. And luckily I had none of that. So I was incredibly fortunate until I went to graduate school and that was a whole other thing. But yeah, I had no idea.
Well, any debt sufferers listening today are likely to feel more hopeful by the end of the episode because Farnoosh Torabi is such a brilliant and inspiring financial mind.
The Upgrade is brought to you by Zapier. Growing a business is hard, especially when you're wasting hours every day moving data from emails to spreadsheets to your CRM to wherever. Shouldn't that kind of stuff just happen without you lifting a finger? Zapier can help. Zapier is the easiest way to automate your work. It connects all your business software and handles work for you so you can focus on the things that matter most. No more wasting your time on tasks that you know could be automated, because that's exactly what Zapier was built to do. Zapier supports more than 1,500 business applications, so the possibilities are virtually endless. Best of all, it's easy to build the exact solution you need in minutes without writing code or asking a developer for help. Join more than 4.5 million people who are saving an average of 40 hours per month by using Zapier. Right now through November, try Zapier free by going to our special link, zapier.com/lifehacker. That's zapier.com/lifehacker for your free 14-day trial. zapier.com/lifehacker.
And now for our Q&A with Lisa Rowan. Lisa is the editor of Lifehacker's financial section, 2 Cents, and this week she's answering both reader and listener-submitted questions about credit cards. Welcome to The Upgrade, Lisa.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so this week we've got reader and listener-submitted questions about credit cards, so I'm gonna hit you with some questions, okay? You ready?
Please do.
The first question is, how do airline miles work?
Of course, start with the most complex question possible.
Yeah.
And I will start by saying that it's really a game where for the money that you spend, you are rewarded with points or miles that can be converted into travel. We call them airline miles because they used to be rewards that you got based on how far you flew. But now it's all about your spending. So when you spend money, you get a certain amount of points that you can convert into credit with an airline. And you can earn it directly through the airline when you book a flight, or when you use a credit card that allows you to earn miles or points on any purchase. It could be anything from grocery shopping to gas at the gas station or dining out, for instance. Basically, the rule of thumb is that for every dollar that you spend, you're going to get a penny back. That can vary on either end of that, but if you're trying to figure out how much your points or miles are worth, think about a penny for every dollar.
Can't you get airline miles as well, though, for flying?
You can. If you book directly through an airline and you're a member of their frequent flyer program, you can get points through that airline without having a specific credit card.
Okay. So you get 1% for every dollar you spend, basically.
Basically, that's the deal.
Doesn't seem like enough. I want more.
It really isn't. And it's changed over the years. The airlines and the credit cards have been working to devalue their rewards. So you used to be able to really hack the system and fly basically around the world for pennies on the dollar. And they really tightened up that system as the economy has improved and as more people have gotten savvy to the different ways that they can play the credit card game.
But even with these miles, you can't necessarily get just any flight, right? There are all kinds of restrictions that come with them, typically.
There are restrictions, and they vary both by credit card that you're using and airline that you're using. And one of the things to look out for in a travel rewards credit card is that often if you book travel through that credit card's specific portal, your points are worth more. You get the greatest value if you book travel through that credit card's specific section versus transferring your points to an airline or to a hotel.
Well, that leads us to our next question from a listener. What do you look for when you're choosing a travel card?
Yeah, definitely look for a sign-up bonus. That's one of the things that's most attractive about these travel cards these days, because for a lot of people, your routine spending is not going to be enough to earn you round-trip tickets to anywhere. So a lot of these credit cards are offering sign-up bonuses of 40, 50, or 60,000 points if you spend a certain amount of money in the first few months that you have the credit card. But you have to be careful that you aren't signing up for an offer that's going to put you in a bad position to try to achieve. For instance, if you need to spend $4,000 on your credit card in the first 3 months to get the sign-up bonus, Do you have bills that add up to that that you can put on your credit card? Or are you going to be spending beyond your means to try to get this reward? Another thing you want to look for is rewards for what you actually spend on or airlines that you actually fly already. For instance, if a credit card rewards you at the highest rate for dining out at restaurants, but you're really great at meal planning and you cook at home a lot, then that may not be a good card for you.
Smart. So know yourself.
Yes. Know yourself, know your habits, both in spending and in what you want to do with those rewards that you'll eventually earn.
So next question, what percentage of my credit limit should I be carrying?
This is a tough one, especially when you're thinking about trying to get those rewards on a travel reward card. But if you're trying to keep yourself under control, think about what I like to call the 30-30 rule. So you have a part of your credit score that's called your credit utilization. And that's if you add up all the credit that's available to you from all of your credit cards, that's how much credit you have. And then we're looking at how much you're actually using. And that's your credit utilization. That makes up 30% of your credit score. It's a huge component. So you want to keep that component really healthy. So you should aim to spend less than 30% of your available credit. And the lower, the better. If you can aim for using less than 10% of your available credit, that's the best case scenario.
Okay, so if I have $10,000 credit limit, spend less than $1,000 a month. Is that what you're saying to me?
Exactly. That is exactly what I'm trying to tell you. The less you have in revolving debt on your credit cards, the better. But once you creep up past 30% of what's available for your credit limit, you're going to start to see an impact on your credit score.
Okay. Next question from a listener. How is my credit score impacted if I miss a payment?
If you miss a payment on your credit card, first you're going to get hit with late fees. The minute that's late, you're going to have a fee of $35, sometimes higher than that. So you're going to have a cost up front. And then after 60 days, if you still haven't gotten your bill up to date, you could get hit with a penalty APR on top of the growing interest that you're going to have on that balance. And that could last up to 6 months. For instance, if you had an interest rate of 18% on a credit card and you missed a couple of payments, your interest rate could go up to close to 30%. So that's going to make a big difference on what you end up having to pay back if you get behind on your bill.
That is chilling. 18% to 30%?
It's a total snowball effect. They can do it as soon as you're past that 60-day mark for being up to date on your bill. And look, mistakes happen for everyone. So if you're going through your bills and you realize, oh, heck, I missed my credit card bill by 2 or 3 days, yeah, you're going to have to pay that late fee. But if you can get that bill up to date, it probably won't show on your credit report because your credit card issuers, which are the banks who have given you this line of credit, they only update your credit report through the credit bureaus every 30 days. So you have a tiny bit of leeway if you have just missed one payment by a few days. But if this is an ongoing problem, it's going to impact your credit history and your credit score for quite a while.
If you miss your payment by a couple of days, can you call the credit card company and sort of say, like, can you waive the fee? I'm a regular payer and I just missed this one. Does that ever work?
It's definitely worth calling. If you're truly someone who doesn't routinely miss payments, they'll probably be able to waive the late fee. You have to specifically ask them for that. So you can't just call and say, hey, like I missed my bill. I want to get up to date. Is there anything you can do? You have to use the specific words. Can you waive my late fee? There's some wibbly law about that where a customer service representative is not allowed to take that fee away unless you specifically ask for it.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So please waive my late fee. I love you.
Yes.
You answer, you had that, right?
Yes. Dear credit card company, I'm so sorry.
Dear credit card company,
would you
I love
please
you so much.
Waive my late fee?
Excellent. Okay. So the next question is, why does it hurt my credit score to use a credit card infrequently?
You want to use your credit card, you know, every now and then, even if it's not a card that you turn to often, because if you don't use it, your credit card issuer is going to assume that you don't want to use it anymore, and they could close your card. And it's not that you're doing anything wrong by using credit wisely by not making charges on your credit card. It's that they only want to keep accounts active if people are truly paying attention to that card and keeping it in their roster.
So the next question is, does canceling a credit card affect my credit score?
Yes. And that's why when we were talking about how a credit card company can cancel your card for you if it's not active, that definitely has an impact on your credit score because 15% of your credit score is based on the amount of time that you've been using credit, the length of your history. And the longer it is, the better because you have a good track record with creditors. So if it's your oldest card, try not to close it because that's going to be the card that is helping you build that longer credit history.
Follow-up of my own to this question, is there a number of cards you should be carrying? Is there a minimum or a maximum number of cards?
That depends on your own situation and how comfortable you are using credit. My general rule for this is to get really comfortable with one card before you start adding on others, because it can get confusing. And when you're charging different things on different cards, it's easy to lose track. I would recommend for someone who's comfortable with credit and doesn't have a whole lot of debt, you know, two or three cards should do it. If you have one, that's great. That may be all you need if you have other forms of credit, like maybe a student loan or a mortgage or a car payment. But if you're someone who's trying to build credit, maybe you're younger, once you're comfortable with one, get two or three cards and, you know, be really smart about using them. Know all of the rules and the different fees for using them, but don't get out of control. You hear about these travel hackers who have 40 or 50 credit cards, and they've put in a lot of time and effort to learn that system. So you do not have to aspire to have a whole binder full of credit cards.
Okay, next question. Should I go for points earning or cashback percentage?
It depends on your goals. And if you want simplicity, if you're someone who says, I don't have time to figure out all these points and the airlines, and when do I even have time to travel? That's when a cashback card is a great opportunity for you. Many of the cards that are available now offer a variety of rewards. So you could take your earnings and transfer them into travel, or you could convert them to cash back and use them towards your credit card balance. So if you're someone who doesn't see travel as something that is in your near future, you don't have a big trip planned, don't feel like you have to get a travel card.
You can get more from points than you can from cash back though, typically, right?
Yes, points are usually more valuable when you convert them to travel or other rewards that are separate from cash. We were talking about that 1 cent per dollar rule, that 1%. Sometimes it can be up to 2%, or thinking about 2 cents per dollar when you're converting to airline miles. But that all depends on the credit card issuer. It depends on the airline. It depends on the restrictions. So that can be hard to figure out if you're just getting started with rewards.
So the next question, I think I know your answer to this one. It's, should I automate my monthly payments?
Please automate your monthly payments. It is the best thing you can do for yourself. I don't care if it's the first credit card you have ever gotten and you're right out of college, or if you're nearing retirement. Like, it just benefits you so much to automate your payments because, like we said earlier, the biggest part of your credit score is the fact that you were able to pay your bill on time. So I recommend setting up minimum payments to automatically come out of your bank account each month. It's really easy to set up on your credit card issuer's website. And then make extra payments as needed. If you have a balance you need to pay off that month, or if you are paying off debt, automating that minimum payment gives you further control for thinking about how much you can pay over the course of a month or the course of a year towards that balance. So it just, you know, sets you up, takes care of the bare minimum, and then everything else on top of that, you can manage on your own as you choose.
Plus, it can serve as a reminder to check your balance. Like when I get that notification that my monthly minimum payment has gone through, I know to check the balance and pay the rest of it.
Exactly. You can take a look. And a lot of credit card companies allow you to schedule routine payments for whenever you want. You can set up a payment that will take care of the minimum each month. But then say you're trying to pay down debt, you can also set up payments for maybe $50 a week goes from your checking to your credit card. And that makes it easy for you to get into a habit. It takes away that constant decision of looking at your bank account and thinking, oh, how much do I have to put towards my debt this month?
Last question for you is, what's the minimum credit score you need for most cards?
It is not necessary to have a perfect score to get the best rates on credit cards or the best rates on loans. If you have a score of at least 670, you are what's considered a prime consumer. So you're going to get pretty competitive interest rates with your peers who are also decent credit card users with good history. If you want really good interest rates, if you want the best credit card offers and the coolest credit cards, you know which ones I'm talking about, you should be striving for a credit score of at least 740 or 750. If you can hit that point, you're going to be a really attractive consumer for credit card companies and lenders.
Well, hopefully we've educated everybody and now they can just go forth and get their dream credit cards.
Go get those dreams.
Go get them. Make your dreams come true.
Get those dreams without going into debt. Good luck.
Exactly.
Kids.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you.
The Upgrade is brought to you by Thinkful. Thinking about making a big life change, like switching jobs or leveling up with more skills, can be super exciting. But when it comes down to actually doing it, so much can stop you. The cost, the uncertainty, the fear that things will be more difficult, or even that you don't know where to start. If you've been waiting for the sign that it's time for the next big think in your life, say hello to Thinkful. Thinkful is a tech bootcamp that's focused around your success. They offer immersive and flexible courses in software engineering and data science, data analytics, and product design. You can launch a career completely online with the full support of a one-on-one mentor, career coaches, and a network based in your local area. Thinkful is focused on high-growth fields that are building the future of the tech industry. That's why their graduates have joined the ranks of companies like Google, Amazon, IBM, and Boeing. If you're ready to join the world's next workforce, your time is now. Visit thinkful.com/theupgrade today to learn more about their courses and start building the future you want. That's thinkful.com/theupgrade. And now it's time for the interview. Our guest today is personal finance guru Farnoosh Torabi. Farnoosh is a finance journalist, a New York Times bestselling author, TV personality, and podcaster. Her award-winning podcast, So Money with Farnoosh Torabi, comes out multiple times a week and features tons of her sage financial advice. But today, we're having her on our podcast to help our listeners figure out how to get out of debt. Hi, Farnoosh. Welcome back to The Upgrade.
Thank you.
So talk to us about when you kicked off your career and you were $30,000 in debt. Can you tell us how you ended up like that?
Like so many students, right? I took out loans to study. And in this case, it was graduate student loans, graduate school loans. I was fortunate actually that in my undergraduate, I did not have debt. I got a scholarship and I went to a state school. So it was affordable for my parents to basically pay that tuition. And this was also many years ago. And tuition wasn't quite as crazy as it is today. But that said, I went to graduate school subsequently, and that was a $35,000-$40,000 situation. And for that, I took out about a $20,000 loan. The rest, my parents helped me pay some of my living expenses and supplemented the expenses with that loan that I took out. Then I graduated. And of course, living in New York City doesn't, it's a bit of a price tag on that as well. So I accumulated some credit card debt, which all in all, that's how I got to about $30,000 in total debt. And that, so that was a combination of graduate student loan debt and credit cards.
And what? How did that feel?
Well, it felt, the credit card debt, it did not feel good. The student loan debt, I was sort of okay with because it was on a term of 10 years. The monthly payment was pretty low. The interest rate was not high. It was a federal loan. So I think it was like 3 or 4%. And so I felt that that was affordable for me given where I was in my career. And I was making money fortunately. So I was able to make that payment comfortably. But the credit card debt I just knew was, I was embarrassed. I was especially embarrassed because I knew that my parents would be extremely disappointed if they knew that I had racked up all this debt. And a lot of it was from not necessities, right? This is like just living my life, doing my thing, going out, shopping. I had opened up quite a few store credit cards. I was looking back, I think my situation was not uncommon, and it's still not uncommon. I think you kind of graduate from college or grad school, you get that first job, that first paycheck. It feels really good, but you really have no idea how to budget. You don't really know the rules, the best practices for carrying debt or having a credit card. And I definitely, I blew it in the first couple of years. And I felt like I had failed in some ways, but I also knew that I was a hard worker and that I was going to prioritize this and bring in as much money as I could to knock that down. And I wasn't making a ton of money at the time. So as a journalist, you know, a starting salary, even though I had a graduate degree, I was a glorified intern at a publishing house at a magazine. So making about $18 an hour before taxes. And so I would hustle it. I would get other gigs, other bylines here and there, babysitting, pet sitting. It's just not going out on the weekends, which was really hard in New York City, at least not going out at night, which ends up costing a lot of money if you're not careful and you've been drinking. So all in all, it took about a few years for me to get out of that hole. What really helped to catapult me into a debt-free scenario was, in addition to the side hustles and saving that money, was publishing a book, getting a book deal at around age 25, 26. It was a substantial advance, and I just used that to entirely take out the student loan debt, which again, you know, wasn't emotionally tolling, and financially speaking, it wasn't nasty. It was, again, a low interest rate, but for me, I felt like I really wasn't being an adult and being a responsible adult until I had no debt. And I just wiped it out and it felt really good. Talk about feeling. That was a good day when I got to go on the Sally Mae website and just click pay. All of it. Like, just the month? No, all of it.
Amazing.
So what does that look like if you're making $18 an hour? That's like roughly $36,000 a year, and then you're trying to bring in more money on top of that. Are you living with roommates? Do you have a particularly affordable rent? Do you have a transportation strategy so you don't spend a lot of money on taxis or trains?
All of the above. All of the above. And actually, I lived it so hard that I wrote a book about it. That was the book that I mentioned, You're So Money, Live Rich Even When You're Not. And that was my personal experience, and as well as the reporting that I had done. I was a financial journalist, so it helped that I had a lot of access to people to give me their advice on how to kind of, you know, do more with less. And so, yeah, I live with not just roommates, ladies, I live with a married couple and their cat in a rent-controlled apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And people are like, how'd that go? I'm like, well, it's a quintessential New York experience, isn't it? I mean, it's so quirky. I live with this couple. They were super nice. I had my own bedroom, obviously. But the bedroom also had its own bathroom. So I felt like I was living it up. Like, I didn't have to share a bathroom. I had a doorman. It was a rent-controlled apartment. So my rent was only about $500 a month, which, I don't know, maybe in other parts of the country that's high, but in New York, that's basically free rent.
That's amazing.
And so that was really helpful. I had that actually starting in graduate school, and I was fortunate. I was invited to keep living there even after I graduated and got a job. And so I lived there for another year and a half, 2 years. And that was, I mean, enormously helpful. The side gigs obviously were helpful. But yeah, I called it a hybrid approach to transportation. So definitely was subwaying it most of the time. But if it was a faraway destination at night, didn't want to maybe take the subway, I would share a cab with a friend to halfway there. And then I would hop on the subway. So I would do like the hybrid public-private transportation just to get me to where I needed to be in as safe as possible, but also affordable. Mm-hmm. And I would go home on the weekends. My parents at the time were living a bus ride away, a couple hours, and I would go home and I would pack up as much toilet paper, paper towels, fruit, dry food as I could to bring back on the Greyhound. And that saved me probably like 40, 50 bucks in incidentals and, you know, household goods a week or a month or however often I was going home. I buried myself in work, to be honest. And I've interviewed so many people on my podcast. There have been guests who come on with far graver situations, like $600,000 in debt, $1 million in debt, $200,000 in student loans. And they lived to be on the other side of that. And how they did it was they got really uncomfortable. You know, you can't just go on, you can't just continue your lifestyle and expect that this debt is going to just figure itself out. If you really want to be aggressive about paying down your debt, you have to find a way to, you have to make a dramatic change. And for me, the dramatic change was working all the time. For others, it might be going back home to live with your parents. For others, it might mean getting an additional 3 or 4 roommates. Or it could mean getting a more affordable loan to, you know, refinance the debt that you have, which is a process unto itself. But it is the sort of thing where people just have to buckle down and realize too that this, if they commit to this discomfort, it is short term. It is not forever. And that is what keeps them going. It's like, okay, for the next 2 years, I just have to bring in a lot more money and I will not say no to any jobs. You know, I will babysit. I will drive Uber. I will clean houses. I will work extra shifts at my job, whatever. There's no pride here. It's all about just getting out of debt. And if I can do that and commit to that for the next 18 months, 2 years, that is going to be a bright light at the end of the tunnel. And then you can move on with your life. I mean, this is what people are doing. It's not glamorous. There's no overnight fix. It's just figuring out how to make a dramatic shift that you're okay with for at least a couple of years or longer. And people are heroically paying down debt. It's happening.
Why do you think something so simple becomes so complicated for people? You know, really the solution is you have to make more money and you have to make more money in any way possible and be willing to make these sacrifices. Why do you think that's so difficult for people?
I mean, on paper, getting out of debt is a very simple equation, right? Spend less than you earn, live below your means, and then use that extra to pay down your debt. And in some cases, you know, people wonder, where do I even begin? Well, I'll start with the highest interest rate debt first. That's your most expensive debt. So better to get that out of the picture first. But it's hard because money, as we know, is super emotional. And we have a hard time, I think, finding the motivation sometimes. It can really feel draining. And we may not feel confident like that we can do it, that perhaps we grew up in a household where debt was just a constant reality. And so you're thinking to yourself, this is my reality. You know, I just have to find a way to live with this. And perhaps they don't even know that there are opportunities to make more money. They don't know the resources that are out there. And I do think that so much of getting out of debt is finding a support system, feeling motivated. It's not that we don't know how. You can Google, you can listen to this podcast and, you know, oh, this woman told me I should just work more. But in doing that in a silo without support, without mentorship, without being able to feel like you can talk about it with someone openly and talk through your emotions, it's going to be a lot harder. It is. And again, going back to some of these people that have shared their stories with me on my podcast about erasing 6 figures worth of debt, they didn't do it alone. They often talk about they did it in partnership with a spouse. They went to see a credit counselor. It was no secret to their friends that this was a goal of theirs. So they didn't feel as though they had to hide it. And their friends really rallied around them to make sure that they were able to keep on track. And so I think to answer your question, it's really about feeling emotionally equipped, right? It's we feel the tools are there and the logic is there, but the emotion is where we really need to identify and support and nurture.
And there's so much shame wrapped up in debt too, right? Is there, I mean, I think for a lot of people, you can say like, talk to your friends and talk to your spouse, but people really kind of hide this stuff and keep it in. Are there any kind of support groups or Facebook groups where people can go to kind of discuss?
Yeah, absolutely. There's Debtors Anonymous, which is a very popular, just like it sounds, you know, it's an anonymous group, but they are nationwide and they have groups on Facebook and they have a website. And I know a few people who have gone through that and speak highly of it. There's also the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. It's a nonprofit organization, nfcc.org. They have clinics throughout the country and the first meeting is free. You can walk in, you can probably also schedule a phone call. They will just initially want to learn more about your financial situation, what kind of income do you have, your debt obligations, your spending, and try to give you some a direction in that first meeting. But it may also be concluded that you would benefit from a debt management program. So the NFCC offers these programs that are maybe like $8 or $10 a month to join. And if you're really in dire straits, they can work it out with you. So it's free, perhaps. But it's the kind of program that is it's a slow burn. It's not one of those, you know, marketing messages you might see online that's like, get out of debt overnight. And, you know, it's a very conscientious, collaborative program where they work with you as your advocate to talk to your creditors, try to come up with maybe modification plans for your loans, lower interest rates, reduction of fees to make sure that that monthly payment can be as low as possible for you. But, you know, eventually you're getting out of debt over maybe the course of a few years. But again, I love them because I like the idea of having an advocate and having someone to talk to. If you don't feel comfortable sharing this with family and friends because there's that shame, well, then go to a professional. Well, this is their job. They're used to this. They're not going to judge you. This is their job to help you.
So if somebody's getting inspired listening to this and they're thinking, okay, I want to take that first step. I'm in debt. I'm ready to make that change. I've got to get a handle on this. What's the first thing they should do?
I think the first thing is actually to not really obsess over the numbers and really take a step back and think about what is the whole purpose of this? Because getting out of debt just to get out of debt, you know, that's honor that for some people is just enough, you know, but I need more. I need to know that there's a bigger goal and a purpose here, that this mission to get out of debt is really purpose driven. And certainly, of course, it feels great to not have that financial burden, that check or that bill coming every month. But what will this afford you? And if you have aspirations of, let's say, starting a business, getting married, starting a family, transitioning jobs, traveling more, putting this in context of how this is going to ultimately help you achieve your own personal endeavors. I think that that's important to recognize, to establish, and to keep at the forefront of this journey, because you're going to have days and months where you're really tired of this and you don't want to keep putting money towards the debt because there are more exciting things to do. There is more exciting to spend money. I'll just say it. But so you need to be mindful of the why and populating your desktop, your home, your phone with imagery, with inspirational quotes. It sounds maybe a little too woo-woo for some people, but visualization goes a very long way in helping you achieve your financial goals. That's proven. I mean, it works in a lot of ways. It works for people as CEOs practice visualization, athletes practice visualization. And I think if we take a page out of that visualization doctrine, I think for people who are trying to get out of debt, it works. You know, basically, you have to train your brain, right? You have to condition yourself for this marathon of getting out of debt. And part of that is like keeping your eye on the prize because you will get frustrated. You will want to quit. So at the very beginning, I think first step is just establishing your why. Why am I doing this? How's this going to help me? How am I going to get forward in life when this is out of the picture? And get excited.
Another piece of advice you've given in the past for people who are financially strapped is to find a side hustle. And you talked a little bit about picking up extra writing when you were working as a journalist. But what if you're not doing something that lends itself to freelancing or to picking up more work? How do you find a side hustle when you're not really sure you have skills that you can market on the side?
We all have skills, though. You know, I think that's the first thing that I would say is that, well, it may not seem apparent to us because we're so focused on our particular job at work, but you may not be using so many of your skill sets at the job that you have. If you speak a foreign language, if you are really excellent at math, if you're really clean and organized, if you're a great researcher, you know, I think that there are a lot of skills that we have that we just take for granted because we don't think they're special or we just do them all the time. So we don't necessarily think of them in the context of monetizing them. But certainly there are ways that we can all start making more money. If we just think about the things that we're really good at naturally, or the things that we've excelled at in academics, at work, and how to maybe pinpoint that and turn that into a revenue stream. So if you do speak a foreign language, there are sites out there that you can go on and tutor. There's tutor.com and a bunch of other sites. You could also think about what kinds of resources do you have that you could monetize? Like if you live in an apartment that is pet friendly, you could pet sit, and there's websites that can get you set up with that. If you are great with kids or great with aging adults, you could become a caretaker part-time on the weekends at night. And there are sites again that can get you set up. So thinking about what are the resources that you have, like where you live could be a platform for making money. Like you might even have an extra parking space that you're not using in your driveway. You could probably rent that out if you live near a city or in a city. If you're looking through life through the lens of how to monetize your life and your skill sets and your resources, it's going to happen. Like it's going to be almost like a waterfall. Once it's going to feel like a real trickle at first, but then once you start thinking about that, thinking about life in that way, I think it'll become a lot easier and more, you'll have more clarity around these sorts of monetization opportunities, if that makes sense.
So you told The Cut earlier this year that money was your daughter's first word. Explain.
One of her first words. She's very conversational, my daughter. She loves to talk. And yeah, we were at a restaurant and the server laid down the bill. And she goes, she points to it and she goes, money. And I was like, my job's done. I think it's important for daughters and women and young girls. I think that we could, this is a whole other episode perhaps, but I think I'm giving my son equal education around money as my daughter. He's older, so there are different stages. But I want to make an effort to really make money not a taboo topic in our household, as it is in so many households. And in particular with young girls, I think we send them different messages around money than we do young boys. You know, young girls, I hear it all the time on my podcast when I ask people about what were their early lessons around money growing up. Men are more likely to talk about things like investing and in entrepreneurship and making money, whereas the women will say, you know, I first learned about money in the context of budgeting and spending. And I do think that's a pattern. And I want to hopefully get to a place in our culture where that is no longer the case. And I think it starts with every parent's responsibility. It starts at home.
Awesome. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Farnish.
Thank you.
This is really helpful.
I hope so. Thank you so much. I appreciate you covering this topic, and I'm happy to come by anytime.
The Upgrade is brought to you by LinkedIn. When I'm facing a dilemma at work or wondering how to take the next step in my career, I look to my friends, family, and mentors for support. I've learned a lot from these people, but there's one piece of advice in particular that really stuck with me. A few years ago, I was complaining to a friend of mine about something at a job that I've completely forgotten now, and I'll never forget my friend Vanessa said, "Work is about facts, it's not about feelings." And this stayed with me. This seemed like the perfect way to sort of remove my ego from the situation and to focus on the task at hand. It wasn't about me and whether or not I was worthy or whether or not someone had identified something about me that said something larger about my personality or my prospects in the world. Work is about facts. It's not about feelings. When you're feeling down, when you're feeling personally attacked at work, it's a very useful mantra to repeat to yourself. LinkedIn's new podcast, Hello Monday, with Jesse Hempel, is back for season 2, and the show is filled with this kind of advice, the kind that stays with you. Each week, Jesse sits down with featured guests to uncover lessons you can apply to your career. Find Hello Monday with Jesse Hempel on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
And now it's time for our Upgrade of the Week, where we talk about that one tiny thing that's making a big difference in our lives. Melissa, what's your upgrade this week?
So I wrote about this on Lifehacker yesterday. I love this newsletter called Recommendo, and they had a method for cleaning your AirPods. which is something I've never done, but known that I needed to do. And we had a method on Lifehacker that involved sucking the wax, like, out of the mesh. I felt that that was not the best way. I was not going to find out. So there were several steps in the process of cleaning them in the newsletter, but the one that I found really worked is using poster putty, the stuff that you maybe use to put posters on your wall now, but probably did if you
when you're in college
or a teenager and you didn't. Somehow it still ripped the wallpaper off my wall of my childhood bedroom. But anyway, I now know what it's for. It's for jamming into the little mesh screen of your AirPods or your regular earbuds and removing any debris that has gotten caught there. It's very satisfying. It's a little bit disgusting when I think too hard about it. But my AirPods look great.
Amazing. Farnoosh, what's your upgrade?
Well, I realize I'm very late to this technology, but I have an iPhone like so many people, and that's not the hack. that's not the upgrade. The upgrade is the Books app on the phone, which is free. But, you know, I've for many years been very kind of biased with my book purchasing. I just want to buy the physical book. I've been very late to adopt ebooks. And I think I've bought like one or two ebooks in my life. And I just am much more of a physical book reader. But as my life has gotten busier, two kids, and I noticed I haven't been reading as much as I'd like. And so I've recently learned about a book that came on the market that I really wanted. And I decided to download it onto the Books app in my phone. And guess what, ladies? I finished a 600-page book in like 8 days.
Amazing.
Because I never forgot the book, you know, in my purse. It was always with me. And mm-hmm. I would commute a lot. That week, I happened to have a lot of subway rides. So that's what I would do. And any downtime that I had, it didn't hurt that it was a really good book, too. It was the book She Said by Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey, who broke the Harvey Weinstein story for the New York Times and won the Pulitzer. Fascinating book. But yeah, the Books app, downloading books to my phone. Who knew?
Excellent.
Very nice.
Alice, what's your upgrade?
So this upgrade was actually stolen from fellow Lifehacker staff writer Nick Douglas, who wrote about this in his How We Work feature. He recommended an app called Tiny Cards, which I have since downloaded and I'm finding really fun. It's a flashcards app with decks on a myriad of topics. Some of the decks I've chosen include famous world leaders, the periodic table, and Greek gods. So it works like you think a flashcard app would work. The graphics are totally adorable. It's done by the same people who do Duolingo, so it has that kind of look to it, kind of cute but minimalist. And it's just a really nice way of like learning a little bit while passing the time. It's a much better use of my time than social media, which I have taken off of my phone now. So I no longer waste my time doing that. And yeah, I'm really loving it.
Is it free?
Tiny Cards. It's free.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah.
And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck. Our executive director of audio is Mandana Mofidi, and Brad Fisher mixed the episode.
Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. You can also reach us by calling us at 347-687-8109 and leaving a voicemail, or write to us or send us a voice memo at upgrade@lifehacker.com. Recently, one lovely listener, Alan Zaharia, sent us a couple of really nice emails, and we just want to say thank you, Alan. We appreciate you. Thanks so much for writing.
You can also find us on Twitter at Lifehacker, on Instagram at lifehacker.com, and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. Sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter, full of tips and tricks and hacks, at lifehacker.com/newsletter. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.